What's up?
I downloaded more RAM while I was at it.
You downloaded more RAM?
Oh, yeah. From the internet.
I'm going to let you finish that part of the story, but I have a similar story. When I was younger and I had my first 486 computer, there were lots of companies that would sell you software that claimed to double your RAM, which, of course, I bought. I mean, I mean I convinced my dad to buy. And it did something because it let a game run that was not supposed to run, but I think it probably just lied about what RAM was available and just said, like, yeah, sure, we're running. I think later my dad ended up getting a refund based on some class action lawsuit against those things. But anyway, how did you download RAM?
I mean, I bought physical RAM.
Oh, okay. Well.
But, you know, I bought it on the internet.
Right.
The heatsink was getting obnoxiously loud, and I'm pretty sure it was dying, so I just wanted to buy a new heatsink. And then while I was there, I'm like, you know what? I only have 12 gigs of RAM, and I'm feeling like that's not enough, so I should up it to 32.
12 is a weird number to have.
Yeah, well, I originally had 4 gigs, 2 gig sticks, and then I bought another 8 gigs, 2 4 gig sticks, but I could have, my motherboard has 4 slots for RAM in it, so.
Mm-hmm. I was always taught when I was younger, when I was younger, this is definitely the case. I don't know if it still is because I don't keep up with this stuff anymore, but that it was best to install RAM in matched pairs, which I guess you did, right?
Yes.
So you wouldn't do like a 2 and a 4. I guess you just have two pairs of slots. So you match the 2 and the 2 and the 4 and the 4.
Well, and what's most important is that the clock speed for the RAM is the same.
Ah, okay. Interesting. This is an appropriate topic for me right now because I am, as we record this, I'm looking at my MacBook, which is now 5 years old. The fans run loud and the battery lasts an hour, and it's been saying service battery for like 3 years.
Yeah, you're kind of screwed now.
So I need a laptop. And
maybe you can get a refurbished one.
You think so? This is my question. Is like, here's the thing. I'm not paying for this, right? I've gotten 5 years out of use of this laptop. I think I can convince Thoughtbot to buy me another laptop, or just ask, not even convince. The real hangup has been like, I don't know what to ask for. Like, I've briefly considered just getting a Lenovo.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're good with going away from Mac,
I just don't know if I am. I know I could do it, but
ThinkPads are good. System 76 makes good computers too.
I just don't know if I'm ready to take on, like, you know, I know OS X has its problems, or Mac OS, as I'm supposed to say now, has its problems, but I know the ways around them, and I'm just not sure that I'm ready to, like, have to learn new ways around new problems.
I mean, have you thought about just, like, dual booting Ubuntu for a few weeks?
I guess I could try that.
Or whatever Linux OS you would be running.
The other thing I'm considering is, like you mentioned, is, like, do I go with the 15-inch, you know, what I'm on now is a 15-inch MacBook Pro from 2013, so I would go for the 15-inch MacBook Pro from 2018, except it has the
touch bar. Yeah, but those are crap.
It has the touch bar and a keyboard that, like, I don't mind the feeling of the keyboard. A client provided me one of those laptops for a brief period of time, and I used it, and, like, I hit escape, the actual escape key, a lot in Vim. Other people remap that, but I don't. And so I never really got wholly used to, like, reaching up to wherever escape is supposed to be. Like, I never quite got used to that, and the utility of the touch bar was non-existent, and I found it to be so distracting that I turned it so that, like, it just shows function keys all the time. But I would occasionally, what I discovered is that, like, while I'm not like a classical touch typist. I just do my own form of touch typing. And as my fingers are moving around the keyboard, sometimes I turn my right hand in such a way to, like, maybe hit the B key or something like that. And my pinky goes up
and it hits the touch bar.
It hits the touch bar, which right now maybe it's hitting some of those function keys, but I'm not pressing the function key. But so then all of a sudden, like, you know, when I had touch bar keys up there, it would lock my screen because that's where the lock button was or something. I'd be like, what is happening? It's not what I want. And yeah, I mean, I'm typing wrong, I guess, but, like, it hasn't been an issue until now.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, a computer does not get to tell you how you should or shouldn't be typing.
Mm-hmm. So then, like, okay, maybe the touch bar, you know, Apple does make a MacBook Pro without a touch bar, but it's the 13-inch version. Which, even if you got the 13-inch one with the touch bar, has some limitation. Like, first of all, it's not as beefy of a machine. And then, second of all, it has this weird limitation, which I've seen, like, we have some clients who come to the office who have those machines. and they try and plug into a monitor and discuss, and like we discovered through many, probably like an hour of trial and error, that not all four USB-C ports on the 13-inch MacBook Pro can drive a monitor. Only the ones on, I think, the left-hand side, not the right-hand side.
Oh, that's actually not super surprising, because there does need to be additional hardware capabilities besides just straight USB for the Thunderbolt.
Right. It's not surprising to people who understand that.
Right.
To people who look at a computer and be like, what are you talking about? I have four USB-C ports, and don't distinguish between the port and the protocol that is being communicated over the port, or like whatever.
Right.
That's extremely confusing, and it's buried in some like support article on apple.com that's an issue. And so like that bothers me.
You'd think there'd be at least like a little icon next to it that's like one for USB and then another one that's like USB plus Thunderbolt.
Right. But they're not going to put those icons on there. Come on. The 13-inch with the keys is just really, it's not nearly as powerful a machine as the 15-inch. And it's probably fine for my needs, but it's just like, well, if I'm going to get one, shouldn't I get one that's more powerful?
Well, it still has the new keyboard, right?
Yep.
See, I can't stand the new keyboard or the new trackpad.
Oh, I don't mind the new trackpad. I don't know, bigger, it's fine, I guess. I don't mind that. And I actually don't mind the feel of the keyboard, but I didn't have any problems in the 1 month I used that laptop, but the reported reliability of that keyboard is really, really bad. And I've seen a couple people in the office have issues where they're like, my I key is sticking on a laptop that's like 2 months old. So that's not great. But that said, I'm probably going to end up just saying like, yeah, I mean, just get me the latest 15-inch MacBook Pro. I've been holding out in hopes that like they would rev them soon and like release a 15-inch MacBook Pro with an actual keyboard, or just get rid of the idea of the touch bar entirely. But
that would require them admitting that their brilliant idea was in fact not so brilliant.
They've done that before, you know. I mean, they kill products. I don't know if they've done that on like a, you know, it's, I don't know if they've done that on like design elements of a laptop before, but they've killed products that they, you know, told us were going to be the next greatest thing. iPod.
Sure, but I don't know that they ever roll out a very controversial feature and then remove it in the very next iteration.
Yeah, I guess so. And then, you know, like you mentioned, the other thing is like, maybe I'll just say like, give me a 2015. So it'll be two years newer. It'll have a brand new battery.
Well, the hardware is not significantly different between a 2015 and a 2018.
Okay. I don't keep up, so I know that it would probably be plenty fast enough. Although I will say, like, when I was using that 2015 MacBook Pro for a month from the client, it was noticeably faster and better. Some of that maybe because it was a brand new machine without 5 years of cruft on it. And
well, in 2015 is when they switched to something bridge, you know, whatever the new Intel chipset was.
Haswell? Was that a
Haswell
thing?
Maybe.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
Whatever the chipset was, I remember it was a big deal that they switched to it because their CPUs were getting crufty. But I don't remember if they've bumped it again between now and then, but I know it's not as dramatic of a difference. And really, the limitation, I think, in MacBook hardware these days is not, if you're on an i7 at least, is not the CPU. It's the amount of RAM that you have, and they still don't offer more than 16 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, that was when they first announced these MacBook Pros, that was my major concern, is like, I can't get one with 32 gigs.
Yeah.
Oof, that's rough. And, you know, the laptop I'm having now has 16 gigs, but I just, you know, I always envisioned a world where where every new computer I bought would have double the RAM of the last computer I bought.
I mean, I don't know that there's a need to go beyond 32 right now. Surely there will be at some point in the near future, but definitely 16 is pushing it.
So that's too bad. Anyway, I'll probably end up just saying, give me the Touch Bar MacBook Pro, because most days I work, you know, my 9-to-5 part of the day in clamshell mode with a keyboard and trackpad and a monitor. So I'm not actually using that anyway. And then when I'm at a client office or in a meeting or, you know, doing something at home on my couch, that is when I actually use the keyboard. And, you know, I think it'll probably be okay. And it'll be under warranty. Although that doesn't really help me when I need to get work done and my laptop keyboard is broken. And it's the same reason why I haven't had this battery issue addressed, is because like, to have the battery issue addressed, I have to give up the laptop, which means I have to do work in some other way, which I can do.
Right.
Like when I had to use that laptop for the month, I made sure that I was really good at setting up a computer really quickly, because I was like, okay, I'm gonna spend the time to move on to this computer, but I know that I'm also gonna be moving on to another new computer very soon, so I'm going to make sure I have a script to set up that to like install Homebrew and install. So I based it on the Thoughtbot laptop script basically, and it just does stuff that I want. It's like a customized version of that. And then of course I have my .dot files up in the cloud, the GitHub cloud. So, you know,
I always find like every time I switch to a new computer, there's always some little thing that I was sure was backed up in the cloud, but it's like slightly different, and I have no clue where the hell the configuration for it even is anymore. I have my open source laptop and my work laptop, and on my work laptop, Git wants me to press enter every time I'm reviewing a patch, and on my open source laptop, it doesn't do that. And I'm sure I could just look up the config and find it, but it's just one of those, like, it's always one of those little things like that, that, like, I was certain I had that in my dot files, and it would, you know, just transfer over fine, but...
This computer I actually did a clean install on, like, in 2014, probably. And the thing for me that I totally forgot was that I don't have access to all of the GitHub repos that I once did. So I lost all of that source code. Which isn't a huge deal, but sometimes it's like, oh, I did that thing. How did I do that thing again? It's nice to see that, but whatever. Yeah, so I guess we'll see. We'll see where I end up.
I remember back when I was excited to get a computer that had 10 gigabyte hard drive.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Much less 10 gigs of RAM.
Right.
And so it's kind of ridiculous to go, 16 gigs is really just not enough. And so I just, like, pulled up on my MacBook. I have nothing that I would expect to be using any significant amount of memory open or running. My computer is using 14 gigabytes of RAM.
So where do I see that? Activity monitor?
Yeah, activity monitor on the memory tab. It's at the bottom.
11.88 gigs is what I'm using right now.
I mean, this is what happens when every single app on your computer embeds an entire web browser.
So kernel task is taking up 1.44 gigs, which who knows?
It's 1.47 for me. That's the operating system doing operating system.
What do you
think
number two is?
Slack.
Yes.
And then number three is Chrome.
Yep. Number three for me is the Gmail instance of Safari. So yeah. Okay. Look at that. Actually, and I have number two is Slack, but that's for the one organization. If I go down to, like, number five, there's another instance of Slack. Yeah, it depends on how I guess it probably depends on how many organizations you belong to on Slack.
Yeah, because I've got seven open and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 instances of Slack Helper.
I have four instances of Slack Helper. The other two are very, like, 70 megs or something, a lot more reasonable than the gig plus that the two main ones are taking up.
Yeah. The idea of Electron is cool and totally makes sense, especially for an MVP for a product. But for a billion-dollar company like Slack, you should have the resources to make a native app that does not create an entire browser instance for every organization that you are signed into.
I'm sure they absolutely do have the resources. The question is, how do you make that argument to people who have invested money in your company, or if you were a public company, to shareholders, that that's the best use of your money? Because it doesn't seem to be hurting your growth right now, right? It can only hurt you because you will not work on other things.
I mean, on the other hand, doing what's best for your customers isn't ever really a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
I mean, I would make the argument like, well, eventually people are just going to get fed up because they literally have to buy a new computer because Slack uses up too much RAM on their current computer and switch to something else, except every other option out there right now also uses Electron.
And Slack's rise to ubiquitousness, I think, was driven by end users, as far as I can tell.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not. And again, I'm not saying, like, it makes complete sense for an MVP.
Right. And so that's what I'm saying is, like, maybe they should consider keeping those end users. Like, I would say something like, I don't know. I don't want to give out an example, but there's a lot of things that we use as users of business software, like Slack is essentially, that are driven by enterprise purchasing decisions. Right. And I don't think Slack's ubiquity to me seemed more driven by people who were using similar tools and found value in the way that Slack did things instead. So like, to me, the major thing was like, oh, look how many integrations there are and look how easy they are to get set up. OK, great. Got it. I understand. And that was its major selling point to me. But I think that when people were moving from things like HipChat and Campfire to this, that I was hearing excitement from end users, not like, oh, my company has bought this thing that we're now using.
Right. I don't know. It just always frustrates me. Like, I agree with the notion that, you know, CPU time is cheaper than dev time.
Mm-hmm.
But that philosophy should have never leaked to stuff that runs on your users' machines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, tell the entire web that, I guess.
Right.
yeah.
Oh, so speaking of that, should we talk about CoinHive?
I don't know anything about this.
Oh, you don't?
No. Fill me in.
Okay, so there is a cryptocurrency. I believe it's brand new. At least I hadn't heard about it until this thing started becoming a scourge on the internet. It's called Monero. And basically, the big thing that made it different is that there is a mining client written in JavaScript.
Okay.
So if you go to salon.com with an ad blocker turned on,
mm-hmm.
your browser tab will immediately start using 100% of your machine's CPU.
Oh, so this is like their response to like, oh, if you want to block, you're going to block ads, then we're going to
then
mine,
we're
going to
use you, we're going to mine cryptocurrency.
Cryptocurrency.
Yeah, which I don't know that I hate the idea behind it.
Oh, I do. I hate the idea behind it.
I certainly hate the it uses 100% of your CPU and not, you know, a small reasonable fraction of your CPU. And certainly I hate how shady it's being implemented.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't mind the idea of they're giving you shit for free. They need to find some way to monetize their content and they're going to lose the ad blocker war eventually. Of course, ad blockers are just going to start blocking this script. But
right.
But yeah, and so it's starting to be like everywhere. And the problem is, at least Salon, I remember it was a big kerfuffle with them, and they at least have, you know, the full page, hey, looks like you're using an ad blocker, and at least ask you, we're going to use your CPU if you want to keep blocking ads. And so at least they try to inform you slightly, and you kind of sort of opt in. I still don't think that it's sufficiently informing the user of like exactly what's going on, but... Plenty of other websites just aren't even bothering to ask your permission or inform you.
Does it
you.
Do that on battery, too? It uses 100% of your CPU on battery?
Oh, yeah. It just, you know, consumes every resource it can. It's a crypto miner. That's its job.
I'm browsing salon.com. It's not giving me any sort of notice that anything's happening, but I do have...
They might have stopped it. It was a few weeks ago that it was a big kerfuffle.
I also maybe, since I'm using a different browser than people, maybe they're not as sophisticated at checking for ad blockers on different
browsers.
Yeah,
so if I go to salon.com, I'm in Chrome with AdBlock Plus turned on, and the very first thing I see is, we notice you're using an ad blocker, suppress ads, beta, block ads by allowing Salon to use your unused computing power.
Yeah, it'll the rest of your computing power will be unused because you don't have it anymore.
Yeah, it got bad enough. And I was noticing it enough on my phone, because my phone would get physically hot, that I actually switched web browsers. There's a browser on Android, I think it's on iOS too, called Brave, which is just a fork of Chrome, but has a built-in ad blocker and specifically also blocks this crypto miner.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually really surprised with how well it integrated with Android, because Android's sort of tightly coupled to Chrome these days. But everywhere that it was using Chrome before now, like web views in apps open in Brave now. And even every time you've got a web view in Android, there's the, you know, drop down menu for all of the options. And one of the options was open this in Chrome. It used to say open in browser, then it starts saying open in Chrome. And now it actually even says open in Brave, which I was just surprised, like, oh.
Yeah.
I didn't think Google would be like willing to let people actually just swap that out.
Yeah, on OS X, there's no default system thing for that, but apps will sometimes like detect if you have other browsers or other email clients or whatever installed and give you an option of like setting your default.
On iOS?
Yeah. Is that what I said? Okay.
You said OS X.
Oh, I meant iOS. Yeah. So some apps will try and detect that, but the built-in system stuff doesn't.
Right, but I mean, WebViews was the one that really surprised me.
Right. Yeah, and they also recently made a change to WebViews, which I support wholeheartedly, but man, it's kind of a bummer. Is like... So WebViews in-app used to share your cookies and things with the regular mobile Safari.
Yeah.
So if you were signed in to... If they didn't share, they at least persisted between WebViews and that app. I'm not entirely sure. But like, so I use the Gmail app only for my work email, right? Because I like to keep my work email separate from my personal email so that like going to my work email is a conscious, like, I'm going to check my work email now. And so I use the Gmail app. I open up the Gmail app and there'll be like a link to GitHub. And so I'll click it and it'll open up in a web view, in a Safari web view inside Gmail. And it'll say like page not found because I'm not signed into GitHub. And so
wanted a link in an email to open in a web view as opposed to opening the browser?
That's a good point. And the Gmail app will actually ask you, it'll be like, hey, every time you click on a link until you tell it not to do this anymore, it opens a little thing on the bottom of the screen that says like, do you want to open this in Safari? And Safari has like an open button next to it, or Chrome, and Chrome has like a get Chrome download link, you know? And so it really, and I'm like, no, open it in Safari. But what they really mean is like, we'll just use a Safari web view inside this app.
I mean, I'll bet they also just mean we'll use a Chrome web view.
Right. I did download Chrome on the train this morning just to get around this issue. I was like, if I have Chrome, I wonder if I'll stop having to sign in to GitHub to check like a pull request from my phone.
I wish every app that used WebViews had an option to never use WebViews.
To always like open Safari?
Yeah. Especially because like on Android, there's not even a usability argument for WebViews because there's the hardware back button, which takes you to the last screen you were on, which will be back to whatever app you were in that had the link. Because like when I'm browsing Twitter, for example, I tend to click on links a ton, and oftentimes it's for articles that I don't want to read right now, and I just kind of keep open Chrome tabs as my read later list.
Mm-hmm.
And I always forget, oh, nope, this is going to open a web view. Have to go through like five more clicks to actually get this in an open tab.
Yeah, I use Instapaper for that, but keeping the open tabs would certainly be an option for that.
I mean, it also kills multitasking. Like, let's say I'm reading an article in the Twitter app in a web view, and then I get a DM, and I click the notification to go to my DMs, right? Because it's the same app now, I've completely lost that state, and it won't take me back. It won't take me back to the article I had open.
And when those things first, at least on iOS, when those things first started coming, I liked them because they were much, much faster than the app switching was on an iPhone. But that's probably no longer the case on newer phones, and really should be a solvable problem if it is. So I think it's less, you know, I would rather it open in Safari, probably. This is the We Grumble About Computers episode.
About technology and computers and how everything has become terrible.
Okay, so while we're on that, today, Thoughtbot launched a thing on Product Hub. It's our purpose-built campaign, which is like, it's if you go to thoughtbot.com/resources, it's like a resource center for entrepreneurs about, it has information about, you know, how to test a product quickly, how to get to market quickly, how to ensure quality, things like that, things that founders might be interested in. So this was on Product Hunt. And I was like, oh, you know, I want to support Thoughtbot. I'll go over to Product Hunt and I'll create an account and I'll upvote it, right? And so I go to upvote and it's like, yeah, you got to create an account. And I'm like, okay, great. But there's no options, of course, to create an account locally. I have to sign in with something. So the options are like Twitter, Facebook, or AngelList or something. And so I don't have any of those other two. So I was like, all right, I guess I'll sign in with Twitter. And then it immediately tells me like the list of permissions it wants. So the list of permissions it wants aren't just like, hey, we want to be able to identify you. It's like, we want to be able to identify you. We want to be able to tweet as you. And it told me before I clicked the button, it said like, we're never going to send a tweet without your consent. And I was like, okay, right. Product Hunt, they're kind of, you know, they've been around. I trust them. And then it was like, they also want to read my timeline, see who I'm following, like all of these permissions that they want to have. And so I granted them. Because I was like, I do want to do this. And, you know, they are a legitimate company. So I granted them and I did my upvote and I looked around the site some more. And then I went back to Twitter and I revoked the rights. And I was like, and it's just like, I understand why they do it because they have features on the website, I imagine, that will like tweet for you or will, you know, help you look up people that you follow on Twitter to also follow them on Product Hunt or things like that, which make a lot of sense as a feature that users will like. But I just wish there was a way for them to. I mean, there is a way. They could ask, when I go to use those features, they could ask for those elevated permissions.
Right.
But it's a terrible user experience, right? So it's like, it's a trade-off. What I wish in OAuth, and this, I don't think this is possible in OAuth, and I think it's a limitation of the framework, but maybe not, would be a way to say, like, for an app to request all the permissions it wants and to say, these are the ones I require in order to use the website. Mm-hmm. And you could say, like, I don't want to let you read my Twitter stream, and I don't want to let you see my followers, right? I just want to let you identify me. And if the website is like, that's okay, that's the minimal I needed, it can even say, like, on return, it can be like, I noticed you didn't grant us all the permissions we requested. This means that when you go to use certain features of the site, we may have to ask for more permissions, right? And I think the majority of people would still go through that workflow and say, like, yeah, I'll just give you all the permissions because the majority of people don't care like I care.
Right.
And it would still leave me as a user of Product Hunt because right now, if I go back, I don't know, maybe I can log in still, but eventually I will not be able to log in anymore.
I mean, I'm surprised Twitter, at the very least, has not yet added a compose tweet permission.
Oh, right. Well,
usually when people are like, we will never tweet without your permission, it's because they write a tweet for you and give you a chance to edit it before it's sent.
Right. I mean, there is a compose tweet permission. It's we will formulate a link to Twitter with your tweet as a URL, as a query parameter.
Yeah, I don't know. This was a thing that like was really bad in Android up until recently as well, where apps have basically always had semi-granular permissions, but it was always an all or nothing thing when you install the app. Mm-hmm. And in really old versions of Android, it was a big problem of just the permissions that an app needed were way, way too buried. And so then they eventually made it like if you tried to install an app that needed any permissions other than the default stuff, it would give you a pop-up window. And then they eventually changed it to be like make the things that you should care about much more prominent. Because like able to access the internet is not a permission that is granted to apps by default. Virtually every app is going to need it. And then finally, they eventually, you know, kind of copied iOS and switched it to apps can ask for permissions as they need it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I do think is generally the best approach.
I also like the iOS approach of you can ask for it when you need it. If the user says no, you cannot ask them again.
Android lets you ask twice.
You can't. You can ask them again, but you can't present this simple like yes or no interface. You can ask them again, and then if they say yes, you can open the settings for them, I think, to the page where they can like configure the setting properly, which maybe is a bit too far. But like, I just like that. I can see that being confusing for users who later want to opt in, but I like it from a perspective of like apps can't hound me for this.
Yeah, no, and Android did the same thing. It's you can ask twice. The second time it gives, you know, this app will not be able to ask for this permission again.
Yeah.
The idea being, yeah, so you go to a thing that needs the camera, and for most people it'll be kind of obvious, like, oh, I just clicked a thing that's take a picture, and now it's asking me for access to my camera. Okay. And, but mm-hmm. then if somebody clicks no, the app can say, hey, if you want us to, you know, do a photo filter or whatever the app is trying to do, we need access to your camera. We're gonna ask you again. You need to give us access to this if you want to use this feature.
Right.
But then after the second time, they're completely locked out and they just get an exception if they try and ask again.
I imagine Android apps must do this too, but like iOS apps have kind of gotten around this by instead of starting with the presentation of the official dialogue.
Yeah, they show the screen.
They start their own dialogue that's like, hey, we're about to ask you for this permission. Is it okay? And if you say no, they don't go to that second screen. They just continue to badger you. Like I have the Reddit app on iOS and it's continually like, hey, do you want to enable push notifications? And I say no. And so then I was like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say yes, and then I'm going to say no. So I say yes, and then the iOS thing shows up, and then I say no, because I know then they can't ask me again.
Yeah.
But their app still presents the app space dialogue of like, hey, do you want to enable...
Even if they can't ask you anymore, they still present it?
They still present it, and then I imagine if I say yes, it says like, go to settings and blah, 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 but I've never said yes the second time.
Yeah, I mean, apps definitely do it on Android. You know, it's considered a best practice in Android to only ever do it before the second time that you ask.
Only ever do... Oh, the interstitial
app level, like, yeah. Hey, we are about to ask you about this thing.
We would like to ask you about this thing. Is it okay if we ask you? Yes. Now we are asking you about the thing.
Well, the idea presumably being that if they click no the first time, it's because for many apps, it'll be because they don't understand why you need that permission in the first place.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, I don't know if that method of OAuthing would be supported, but it would be one that I, as somebody who cares about the granularity of permissions I'm granting to my Twitter account or to my Google account or whatever when I sign in with those things, would very much like it. I have basically, for all but like things that have obvious utility need to like do something more than identify me via that service, I basically just will not sign up for that service for the most part. Unless it's like I'm signing up for Buffer or something like that that's going to send out tweets for me on a schedule, which isn't something I'm signing up for. But like clearly if I were going to sign up for that, I have to say like, yeah, you can tweet as me. But for most things, I would just say, forget it. I don't need to sign up for this app. And I know I'm in the minority and very few people actually care to capture that minority. It's not worth it to them, I guess. So, oh, well.
I don't know. On the topic of notifications or permissions, rather, we need to track down the person responsible for the web notifications API and have a very, very long talk with them.
I love this episode of our podcast. Yeah.
You know, I actually click yes, you can send me notifications for the first time.
For a web?
Google Calendar can use it now, which is like the only app that I want notifications from. Boy, why does every news site...
Yeah, why do news sites want to do this? I don't...
Has anybody ever clicked yes on that?
Like, oh man, I really want to know what, and it's like weird news sites too. Like, you know, somebody links you to like a Mac rumor website or something like that. And you like click through and you're right. And they're like, hey, we want to notify you about new posts. You're like, I just want to hear if there's a new MacBook Pro coming out.
And then 5 seconds later, it's, you know, long enough that you've started reading the first paragraph. It now interrupts you with a full page ad to sign up for their mailing list.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. I could go without that. Is there a, I'm trying to think. I'm looking at the settings for Safari about like what it allows.
Oh, I'm sure there must be a setting somewhere that's like disable this permission for all websites.
Yeah. So like location being, but like, I don't think oh, it is notifications. Look at that. Allow websites to ask for permission to send push notifications. Oh, I'm turning that off. Like, here's the list of things I've already, like there's a long list of things that I've already denied.
Yeah.
Kevin MD? What is Kevin MD? I'm sorry if Kevin MD is a listener, but CNN breaking news, New York Times, Tom's Hardware. Clearly I was reading about some hardware and they wanted to send AOL.com. I don't know why I was there. I'm embarrassed to admit it, but they did try and put things in. And location is similar. I guess like maybe some weather websites, but I'm probably I don't know. Maybe I'll leave location on, but
I mean, it's hilarious too, because none of the sites that you would expect to use it ever ask. Like Reddit, for example, they have direct messages. I wouldn't grant them permission to give me a notification when somebody DMs me, but like that is a place that you would expect notifications to be a thing that exists. Definitely not Tom's Hardware.
I don't know. Maybe Tom's Hardware has a really passionate community, like a forum community that like is sending DMs. Who knows? I don't know.
I mean, I'm assuming it's every time a new article is posted.
Yeah, I'm sure it is too. What is Kevin MD? Let's see. I might have to edit this out. Who knows what Kevin MD is? Social media's leading physician voice. Oh, so I clearly went to this website when I was trying to diagnose me or my child with some with some life-threatening disease, which is what I do in my spare time.
I don't know. I'm going to be honest. I think the internet is kind of ruined at this point. I think it's time we just call it quits, start over, new internet.
Internet too.
Yeah.
That was a thing. It's like a university-to-university connection thing. I don't know. I remember hearing about it in college. So I guess we'll have to go with Internet 3. Yeah, I think JavaScript ruined it for the
most part.
JavaScript
was a big part of it.
Yeah, it's really too bad. It had a nice run.
It did. But yeah, I think we're going to call it now. Internet over. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, Bitcoin mining and all the security things. And yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But if you want a web app built, you just, you know, you call us. At Thoughtbot, we make non-intrusive, horrible web applications, usually mostly server rendered.
I like it.
Yeah. Anything else? This is our gripes episode.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to briefly talk about, you know, fast attributes is probably done, but
oh, yeah,
we've been going for 40 minutes.
Let's give the folks, you know, if you've got a brief update on fast attributes, let's give them a little bit of Railsy technical content here.
Sure. Yeah. So fast attributes, it's been long enough that I should mention what it is for those who don't know. There are some things in Active Record that are a bunch of objects that are good that they exist. They prevent a lot of bugs, but they don't need to be Ruby objects because they are entirely internal to Active Record, and I wanted to remove them from Ruby's garbage collection and also do some more efficient allocation. So I took these three classes and rewrote them like line for line in Rust, pretty much, and it makes Active Record twice as fast, which I expect will mean about a 10% increase in raw throughput for a regular app. Because even, you know, a macro benchmark for Active Record is still a micro benchmark for a full request response cycle. Anyway, I had to take a break from it, number one, because I just was getting a little burnt out, and number two, because I had some more directly applicable work-related things I had to focus on for a couple months. But I started coming back to it recently, and it was mostly done. There's a really long tail of stuff that you have to implement in Ruby that people just sort of expect to work, and maybe if you're inheriting from objects, like, coincidentally works, like marshalling and YAML serialization. And so I've been kind of working through all of those things that are just annoying that I have to make work, but I need to make work. But what I realized, because what I wanted to do before we make the gem public, is I want to try it out at Shopify and make sure that it doesn't break our app, basically. And because Shopify uses YAML serialized Active Record objects a lot, and just implementing YAML serialization wasn't going to be enough. I needed to make sure that it emitted identical YAML to what Rails 5.2 emits. So that way I could put it on 1% of Shopify servers and see what happens without, you know, that causing a bunch of cached objects that are not readable by the other 99% of servers.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally figured out a really incredibly hacky way to lie to Psyc about what class an object is.
Psyc being the YAML processor.
Yeah, when you do YAML in Ruby since version like 1.9 or 2.0, mm-hmm. It's Psyc, which was the replacement for Sick. But anyway, there's a method that is not intended to be used to change the class tag that it emits for an object, but it turns out that it happens to do that, so we're just calling that. That worked. So it's probably done. I still have not yet tried it on Shopify yet, at least not in production or even on CI. I need to still figure out packaging for it. And like, I've run random test files locally because that's about the extent I can do. You can't run the entire Shopify test suite on your local machine. I've picked some random test files. I'm like, this seems like it will test a lot of things. So, and nothing is broken. So the reason I've stopped there for the moment is that CI and production are Linux, and I need to figure out how to cross compile for Linux and then, you know, package it so that we don't have to compile it on those machines itself. They can just, you know, gem install. But that I'm hoping to get figured out this week or early next week. And then, you know, if we put it in production and it doesn't break things, then we'll probably make the gem public shortly after that. So
awesome.
Hopefully by the time this episode comes out, actually. But we'll
see. Wow. That'll be awesome. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I'll be excited to see how it fares.
Yeah, I'm just excited to see if the performance gains are actually as big as they've been when I benchmark like scaffolded Rails apps.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
Don't congratulate me yet. Once everything's actually 10% faster, then we can do congratulations.
Okay. I'll congratulate you even when you get it to work on all platforms and on CI and it works on 1% of your servers. Then I'll congratulate you, right. Even if it's not faster. You made a thing, and congratulations.
Well, if it's not faster, that sort of defeats the purpose of it.
Well, but you would have discovered that it doesn't work. Science. You did some science, kind of.
Yeah.
Okay. So should we wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/145.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about any of our episodes, you can tweet us at _bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on our website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast was brought to you by ThoughtBot. We are experienced designers and developers who turn your idea into the right product. With local studios in Boston, San Francisco, New York, London, Austin, Raleigh, and Washington, D.C., let's build something great together.